Welcome to Building with Brick, foundational wisdom on coaching, careers, and Christ. This leadership podcast was spawned by Coach Brickner's book, So You Want to Be a Coach, which is the story of a corporate executive who made a drastic career change and became a head men's basketball coach. Dr. Brickner's book is available in paperback, ebook, and audiobook on Amazon.com, or go to his website, www.drjoebrickner.com. That's drjoebrickner.com. Now, here's this week's podcast. Welcome to Building with Brick, foundational wisdom on coaching, careers, and Christ. Today, I've got a guest that is another special one. Every time I have a special guest, and today's special guest is Jerry Reynolds. Jerry is a 35-year veteran of Sacramento Kings, and we're going to talk a little bit about his early story and how he eventually got to the Kings, but when he did get to the Kings, he was, quote, the second assistant, and I'm not sure exactly what that means other than he's not the number one assistant, and today there's about 50 assistants.
Yeah, there is.
So, eventually, he wore almost every hat you could wear in the organization and was the color analyst for 20 years on the radio broadcast or TV broadcast. Jerry, we're just thrilled to have you with us today. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you. I really am looking forward to it. I've heard good things. And so, just hopefully have some fun.
Well, I'm sure we can. You know, we have one guy in common, and that's Bill O'Connor. And Billy was a guest of mine, and I did a long-term interview with him, and he introduced us. So this is the first time we've actually talked face-to-face. And for me, this is a real treat. There's some names in your past that, you know, I've run across, and it'll be interesting to see what your take is on some of those. But now you grew up in French Lick, Indiana, is what I read.
That is in the area. Actually, I was born and raised in the suburbs.
Suburbs of French Lick.
Yeah. So we were, you know, about 3-4 miles outside of French Lick,
Well, O'Connor tells a story that you were inducted in some Hall of Fame at the same time as Larry Bird, because everybody in the whole world knows that Larry Bird's from there. How'd that go?
Well, it actually wasn't exactly the same time. Basically, the Springs Valley High School, where we both went to school and certainly played and all that in French Lick. It's a small consolidated school, about 350 in high school. But the gymnasium seat about 3,500.
Isn't that amazing?
but that's Indiana.
Yeah.
So actually, Larry had his jersey retired, I think, in the late 90s, the only jersey retired, and, you know, had a nice plaque and everything and about all of his accomplishments. And then a few years later, they decided to retire mine, and same kind of thing, a little plaque, and they hung them right together. And so I called Larry, and I said, you know, I just was at the gym when my brother was still alive, and we were looking at the deal, and I said, you know, it looks pretty nice. I said, you know, my jersey, your jersey hanging there, both got plaques. I said, you know, they had listed kind of my achievements, and you know, surprisingly, they kind of mentioned some things you, I guess, did. I don't know. and then I said, so it appears to me, Larry, I said, you know, we're pretty much on the equal footing here, you know. And Larry, typical Larry, he said, Jerry, you silly little dumb shit, you did you forget you drove up Larry Bird Boulevard to get there to see it? And I said, well, great point there, Larry. I think I understand the difference now.
That's great. Well, you had gone to JUCO at Vincennes. And
yeah.
I guess car accident kept you from continuing your basketball career, but you went into coaching. And
it was kind of an interesting thing. I went to Vincennes University. That's the name of the school, but it's a junior college to play. And a couple of schools had kind of encouraged me to place me there, that they would recruit me later type thing. And then middle of my second year, I was in a really bad car wreck, and I was hurt pretty bad, but I was a passenger in the back, but the driver was killed, and and the other passenger in the front seat was paralyzed. And later took his own life. And then another passenger in the back with me was hurt, but was not bad. He wasn't in the hospital, but I had to spend quite a bit of time due to some serious back and head injuries, things like that. But so it pretty much ended, you know, my playing career. But then I, in a way, it maybe, you know, from that, I definitely started thinking more about coaching and teaching, things of that nature. So it's one of those things, really just one of those traumatic turning points in life, so to speak.
Well, I know a lot of folks probably don't remember. They have to be a little bit older, like we are. Don't remember how good Vincennes was, because I think they won the national tournament in 1970. Is that?
Well, actually, they'd won it in 65. I wasn't there at that time, but that was also in 70 and 72.
Yeah.
So I was involved with two national championship teams in Vincennes, and you know, we had just great players. Bob McAdoo, one of the all-time great players, one of the top 75, was there, and I recruited Mac, and Clarence Footsie Walker, who played 10 years in the NBA. And
was he at West Georgia? Did he go to West Georgia?
I went to West Georgia, and then Footsie came with me, and also Dave Edmonds, who played on the 72 national team, and Tommy Turner, Tommy Terrific, they called him. He had actually transferred back from another four-year school. He's unhappy. He wanted to come to West Georgia. And we won a national championship there in 1974.
Yeah, I remember that.
We were really truthfully, I mean, even though we were college division, we were far better than University of Georgia or Georgia Tech.
Yeah.
And we just had better players. And of course, I always said that Vincennes, and Bob McAdoo would tell you that. He said we had more talent at Vincennes than he played with at North Carolina.
That's amazing. Well, you know, JUCO was that way back then, though. I mean, there wasn't really a developmental league with the pros or anything. You went to JUCO, and had you gone to the four-year school, you had to sit out as a freshman. And so there were some great players in junior college.
Yeah, people forget that. But when I would say during my time there as a coach, Artis Gilmore, Spencer Haywood, Freddie Brown, Nate Archibald comes to mind. You know, all those guys played the junior college.
Yeah.
I mean, I could probably, you know, go on and on. But, they basically, most of the four-year schools had stricter academic rules at that time. And as you said, they couldn't play. Freshmen couldn't play.
Right.
And so there was a lot of reasons why some of the top, really top players would choose to go junior college first. I know in Bob McAdoo's case, he really wanted to, he was from Greensboro, North Carolina, and his parents both wanted him to play at North Carolina, but the academic restrictions at that time, he just barely couldn't qualify. Now he could have went to a whole bunch of other schools, I think Western Kentucky and Louisville and places like that were recruiting him, but that's where he wanted to go. So that was a way that I, tried to get in there to encourage him, that this would be the way he could go to North Carolina. And certainly I'd have to say Mac probably wasn't as enthused about doing it as his parents were, but his mother in particular was a teacher, and she just simply wanted Bob to play for the Tar Heels. So it all worked out.
Well, the other thing in West Georgia, again, a lot of people don't understand how good NAIA was back then. Cause I know when the team that I was on in 67 at St. Benedict's, we won the national title there, and there were 540 some schools, I think, in the NAIA. And back then, if you were Black and you're in the South, you didn't play major college basketball. You played NAI basketball. So the talent is unbelievable.
It was tremendous. Yeah. You know, I worked for a while with Willis Reed, who played at Grambling. That was a NAI school for at that time or a different time. So, just marvelous players. That's where they went, you know. And then my time at West Georgia and then at Rockhurst, I mean, I know at West Georgia, we beat Gardner Webb with John Drew.
Yeah.
He's an outstanding player in the NBA. And the year before, I think the championship was won by a team led by Lloyd Free, which later became World B Free, and Bob Kaufman, who had a long career in the NBA.
Yeah, Buffalo Braves.
Gosh, I'm trying to think of the guy at the Celtics, played for the Celtics for a long time. Towel waiver. I'm having a brain. But he was, and you know, he coached them for a little while. But he played on that same team. You know, so they had three pros. You know, I mean, good. And of course, Lloyd was a real star.
Yeah.
That's what you had to do. I mean, I always said at West Georgia at that time, and later Rockhurst. I mean, even though we weren't as talented, but if you didn't have legitimate major college talent, even though you were playing college division, you couldn't win. You just couldn't do it. You had to have guys who were capable of playing at a higher level, even though they were at a lower level. And then, like I say, back in the 70s, you better have probably some NBA potential players.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that West Georgia team, we had three guys drafted off that team. Cliff Walker, Tommy Turner, and Jerry Faulkner were all – oh, I take that back, four. Dave Edmonds was drafted, too, by the Phoenix Suns. So we had four guys drafted off that college division team. So,
that's amazing. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, I read also that Cotton Fitzsimmons was one of the reasons you got the Rockhurst job. And Cotton, I think he was an Atlanta Hawks coach at that time, but had he not come from the Kings? Is that?
No. He had basically, let's see, he hadn't got to the Kings yet. He later got the Kings job. Yeah. I think he had been with the Phoenix Suns before.
Yeah, I think that's
right. And then I think the Atlanta Hawks, and then the Kings, and then the San Antonio Spurs, and then back to the Suns again for a final run. But anyway, yeah, your point is right. I mean, Cotton was very helpful to me. I'd gotten to meet and know Cotton when he was a junior college coach at Moberly, Missouri.
Yeah.
And Moberly, it was at kind of the end of Cotton's career there. He later went to Kansas State. And but they won two straight national junior college championships. And they were a big rival for us. I think we split with them every year, but we were one of the few teams that could compete with them because they had high major league talent.
Yeah.
You know, everybody they had could play at the top level major college. So I got to know Cotton pretty well. And then when I was at West Georgia, and Cotton was the coach of the Hawks. It was always interesting because in those days you had one assistant coach. Nobody had more than one then. And during summer leagues and veteran camps, a lot of times I'd go over and kind of help. You know, Cotton would always give me some, and I'd help him run his camps, things of that nature. And so, you know, made a little money, but got to be around the NBA and, you know, got to work kind of with some of their players, which is always a treat. I always say it was always exciting because I got to kind of have a relationship to some degree with Pete Maravich at that time.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, and I always tell people, I said, you know, Pete, one of those guys that would have been better, you know, 30 years later than he was at the time. And he was, I mean, he was ahead of his time. He really was.
Yeah.
You know, he was basically, you know, the league didn't really appreciate the entertainment value of some players, and his teammates didn't either. But nowadays, all that would, I mean, he'd be a bigger star today than he was when he played.
Yeah.
And of course, and the rules would have benefited.
Oh yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Well, By the way, I got to go back though. I didn't realize you played at St. Benedict's. I'm having a tough time adjusting here already. You know, I mean, although having said that, you know, we never lost to my years at Rockers. We never lost to St. Benedict's.
Seriously.
Oh, seriously. Look it up. We kicked their butts. Yes.
Is that right?
In the pit. In the pit.
You should have been there a little earlier because we were 7-1 against you guys.
Yeah,
7-1.
You wouldn't have been if I had been there. Also, we won two against St. Benedict's when I was at Pittsburgh State the one year I was there. So I have to say, Joe, I kind of owned you guys. You know,
Oh, that's good. That's good. Well, you know, you talked about Pete Maravich. One of my guests on the podcast had been John Brown, and I'm sure you remember John.
Well, sure.
John and I were teammates for 20, 25 years in the age division stuff after we all got up to about our 40s or so. And John, in talking with him, was so complimentary of Pete Maravich. He said, you know, a lot of times you'd go in as a rookie, and you were treated as a rookie. And he said, I came in, and from day one, Pete came up to me, and he was so kind and considerate and treated me like I was a teammate already. And he said, he was just a wonderful person. And he said, but the things that he did on the court were absolutely amazing compared to what was going on at the time. And your point so, I mean, you see stuff that Steph does and people like that, and you go, that's really something. But you go back and look at the old films, the stuff Pete did.
Oh, he was, I mean, you know, I always say that practices, you know, was just amazing in a sense that you'd always see something. You just take your breath, you know, like, what did I just see? You know, I mean, I always say the only guy I can think of that really today in the modern game that really had a better handle was a kid we had some years ago, Jason Williams. They called him White Chocolate.
Yeah.
I mean, Jay Will, in all honesty, could do everything Pete could do and do it faster.
Really?
You know, I mean, he wasn't near the player, but I mean, as a ball handler, I mean, he was breathtaking.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he had it all, you know. I mean, of course, like if he had tried to play in the 670s or something, he wouldn't have been allowed to because he'd too flashy. But I mean, it was, he probably did more for the Kings franchise at that time to be a, you know, he was a human highlight every night on ESPN, you know, elbow passes. And, you know, I mean, there was nothing he couldn't do with the ball.
That's pretty amazing. That kind of leads into my next question. I mean, 35 years with one franchise, which that probably is close to a record that anybody.
I think it might be. I heard that it is. I have, you know, spent any time checking it out, but.
Yeah, I'll bet it is a record now. And you started as an assistant coach, and then you kind of progressed into different management positions. What changes have you seen in the NBA over your career?
Well, of course, I'd say just the overall NBA itself went from being a kind of a mom and pop business, generally speaking, to a huge corporation. You know, when I came in the league, as you pointed out, I was the Kings' first time they had two assistants. And now, of course, every team probably has 8 or 10 guys. I don't even know. My last few years of broadcasting, we'd fly on the charter with all the, you know, with the team and everything. And there were guys I never did get to know their names. I didn't know who they were or what they did. I don't know if they knew what they did, you know, but I always glad to see a lot of people have jobs, but I think it's kind of over the top, you know, to where, you know, I always thought head coaches probably ought to work with the players themselves. You know, I think you lose a little something when everything is delegated, but I think that's, you know, that's the case today, much like football, you know, to where, the head coach, as Bear Bryant once said, I always remember his book, he said, his last few years, he said, I don't coach players, I coach coaches.
How do you create loyalty as the head coach if you have, and then I look at the benches on the NBA today and I see behind, I see there's like five, six assistants on the bench. And then behind the bench, there's a whole row of other assistants in the same shirts and everything. And I know that they have to be working individually with each player or whatever. So how do you create that loyalty that you really have, I think, to be successful between player and coach if you're not working with the kids every day?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it's very difficult. The only way I could come up with, only thought I've ever been, you better win. Mm. You know, winning, you know, they always talk about culture. You know, how do you develop a winning culture? Very simple, win.
Yeah.
You know, if you're losing, you're not going to have a winning culture. Yeah. Because with the money and the agents and all that, they're if there's not any chinks in the armor, they'll create some.
Yeah.
And I think that applies when you've got a lot of assistants. You know, at some point, guys are looking for their own best interest. You know, I always say players, it's not, you know, in the league, in the NBA, players are individual contractors. Don't forget that. Mm-hmm. And certainly so are the coaches. Mm-hmm. So you have to be looking for your best interest. I would say it's not like the college game, or actually the college game is becoming the NBA game now.
That's right.
But I mean, when I was in college you basically kind of went to a school primarily due to the coach and maybe secondarily due to the school type thing. But now it's who can get me to the pros or, in addition to that, now it's how much can I make on my name and likeness, or somebody will give me. So it's different. But yeah, I don't have a problem with it. I mean, it is professional basketball, and that's what you have to realize, is that the same things don't apply. You know, the coach in the NBA, I've always said, is probably has less impact on winning and losing than a coach at any other level. I always say probably if you really did it, probably a real good coach at the junior high level can almost guarantee you winning, you know, regardless of talent. Levels you go up, a coach, probably talent becomes more important, a coach becomes less important.
Right.
And you get to the highest levels, the talent itself is far more important than the coach. And I mean, it's no disrespect to a Steve Kerr or somebody. But if Curry and Clay and Draymond hadn't been there, or Durant, and you replaced them with, you name some of three or four other guys, what's he going to do? Now, I always say, just my experience as great a coach as I think Greg Popovich is, or Pat Riley, who I think is truly one of the all-time greats. Mm-hmm. I remember, and I kidded Pat about it once, I said, you know, he had two seasons where he won, I think, 15 games one year, and one year 17 games in a season. I said, Pat, I was really a crappy coach, but I never did that bad. I never had a season that bad. And you know, of course, he said, yeah. I said, yeah, it's, he said, obviously, getting to coach Magic and Worthy and Kareem to start my career was a pretty good edge.
No kidding. What is your opinion on guys like LeBron James, who I absolutely a fantastic player, no doubt, but kind of recruiting on their own, trying to create a championship team themselves? What's your take on that?
I don't like that. I think it's probably here to stay, where players want to get with other great players so they can win championships, you know, as opposed to, I kind of prefer the Jordans and the Birds, who say, you know, basically said, you know, wherever I am, I'll win a championship.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I'll do that. They just felt they were good enough to do that. Isaiah Thomas with the Pistons, you know, I mean, but having said all that, it is a bit of a different time, a little more free agent potential movement, things of that nature. So kind of like baseball or football or anything else, you know, where players now have more ability to move and create their own destiny a little bit. And so they do. I can't say I blame them. I just would prefer that players themselves would stay in one spot. You know, I'm old enough to where I grew up a baseball fan, and I knew that Stan Musial played for the Cardinals, would always play for the Cardinals.
Yep.
Ernie Banks for the Cubs.
And always.
Mickey Mantle for the Yankees.
And, yep.
And that sort of thing. And so, but those days are gone. You know, I mean, I think, you know, it wasn't fair to the players, actually, if we look back on it. It's great for fans, but yeah. They were really getting screwed. You know,
I mean, especially Ernie Banks.
But money wise, I mean, okay. they had no freedom. So, yeah. you know, Mickey Mantle was, you know, making $100,000 a year when probably his value might have been, even at that time, would have been 10 times that.
Yeah.
If he could have been on the open market.
Yeah.
So, having said all that, yeah, I like players that stay with teams, but those days are gone. You know, I understand now that guys, because really, you know, why wouldn't and shouldn't players look for their own best interest, since the teams will? You know,
that's right.
The teams darn sure if they feel like you're not good enough as a player or coach or front office, whatever, they'll get rid of you in a minute.
Yeah.
So I always say it's you know, the idea that, you know, you're supposed to have loyalty when it really, for the most part, isn't returned is pretty foolish.
Yeah. You know, and that's in corporate America, that's exactly the way it is today. I had worked for almost 30 years for Southwestern Bell, and I came up at the time where there was this bond or loyalty between employer and employee. And when you worked for Bell, you were part of the Bell family, literally mm-hmm. the family. And they transfer you all over the country, and your friends were always Bell friends. And that changed in about mid 80s. And as soon as they started saying, okay, now bottom line is the most important thing rather than service. And then that bond started to go away. And today it just doesn't exist at all in corporate America. And I'm sure it's the same way in the NBA, is you got to take care of yourself because your employer is not going to take care of you. You know, their interest is bottom line.
And, you know, and then there's once certainly in the NBA, the money is so huge that they feel less, you know, loyalty. And of course, the money's so huge that the players themselves do too. Because if I can make, I'm making 20 million here, but I can go over there, this team, and I can get 30 million. You know, like I say, I'm not a big fan of how it's turned out, but it's
you can understand it. Yeah.
I can understand it, and it's really no real difference. And like you say, corporate America, it's just the way our society is changing a little bit.
Yeah, we moved to that. Whenever I think about, you know, LeBron recruiting all the people that he wanted to, and then Durant going to the Warriors and things like that, and I think, you know, if I'm on the playground, I never try to stack the teams. You just didn't want to stack the teams. You wanted to play against the best and beat people.
Yeah, you want to compete. Yeah,
you really did. And then when you start, when Durant was with the Warriors, I mean, how are you going to beat them?
Yeah.
Three of the best players ever.
Ever. No, it's one of those things. I agree with you. I mean, I think, you know, I think the media is a big part of the problem, in a sense that now we've got this mentality. If you don't get a ring, you're, you know, he doesn't have a ring. It's like, well, what has that got to do with how he's a great player? I mean, that's like saying Karl Malone didn't have a ring, so he wasn't great. Of course he was great. Charles Barkley was great. He just didn't win a championship. It wasn't his fault. I mean, he was great. And I find that, you know, mentality really out there, you know, and they push it all the time. You know, now it's kind of like the Steph Curry thing. You know, they talk about, well, he has never been the MVP of the playoffs, of the finals playoffs. It's like, so what does that have to do with his greatness? You know, I mean, really, you know, the guy's won three championships, been the best player on a championship, three champions and maybe a fourth. And he's been a two-time MVP. So if that doesn't establish greatness, then I don't know what you're looking for.
Yeah, I agree. Speaking of great players, I mean, you've seen them all. I mean, you've been not only involved with the Kings for 35 years, but you were a color commentator for 20 years. So you've seen every player come through and play at least two games a year, maybe four games a year against the Kings. How do you stack up some of the players who are some that just really stand out to you?
Well, probably wouldn't surprise you that LeBron James and Michael Jordan and Larry Bird and Magic Johnson and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar would be very, very high on my list.
Yeah.
I think there, you know, and there's others that probably are Shaq and Kobe and some others are kind of close to that list, but I still think those kind of come out there, that are just remarkable, you know, and I've always said, I'm not sure though that any of them were better than Oscar Robertson at his prime either.
Yeah.
the great Jerry West. I mean, so I've really gotten, they were my heroes, West and Robertson. I've gotten to know them and spend time with them over the years. And so that was always kind of a thrill. Those players I mentioned, I mean, just getting to either coach against them in some cases, but do TV and see them on a nightly basis up close and personal. You realize, true greatness. I mean, just true greatness. That's all you can say. I worked for Bill Russell for a number of years and as an assistant and later as a head coach under him. And I always remember one thing he said. He said, guys like me, he said, people think I'm eccentric. And he was, by the way, very eccentric. he treated me well, but he was very eccentric. But he said, people like me, they think I'm eccentric. But said, that's one of the reasons I'm an all-time great. He said, we're not normal. He said, people like me, God only makes about four or five of my type every 4 or 5 years, I think it's absolutely true, and I know just from being around and up close and personal with Bob McAdoo or Larry Bird. I mean, they're wired different. I mean, they just, as a athlete, you get to thinking that you're a certain level of competitive spirit or work ethic. And then you get around some of those guys and you think, oh boy, this is different.
Yeah.
This is different. There's, I always say, some of those wires are hooked up a little different, but they're all hooked up.
Well, how do you think somebody like a Robertson or a Chamberlain or somebody like that would fare in today's game?
Well, I think if they had time to learn the different rules, the rules are different. They would adjust. Would they be as dominant? Probably not. It's also true. I'm not sure that, say, Steph Curry would be as dominant back in the 80s when it's a lot more physical game and they could put hands on you and no three-point shot early before the three-point shot. So, it goes both ways. Mm-hmm. I just think, again, I kind of go with what Bill Russell said about greatness and comparing people. He said, all I know is, I can't compete against somebody that's not in my era. I can only be great against the people I'm playing against.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a great point. It's, to me, that's like comparing, saying Jesse Owens, obviously his sprint times wouldn't compare with the top sprinters now, but how would he know how fast he had to run? And certainly the training conditions and the tracks and all that are so different.
So I think, to me, I guess
greatness, I just say you should compare eras. Greatness is greatness.
Yeah.
And Oscar and West and Baylor and Chamberlain were truly great. And then today's game, LeBron and Luka Doncic may become an all-time great. So all they can do is play against the guys they play against. Yeah. And the rules of the day, which really is significant.
Yeah. Well, do you say – they played with hands on basically in the older days, but watching the NBA finals, I had to fast forward through the fourth quarter last night. I recorded it and I fast forwarded through it. I got so frustrated because you can play defense with your hands in these playoffs and not with your feet. and you know how hard it is to get by somebody when they're basically holding you, and no, it doesn't matter if you have the ball or not, you're held.
Yeah, it's amazing to me because regular season it's not that way at all. You know, I mean, you touch a guy, especially wings. You know that they change the game to where there's just almost no value in post play, but everything is breaking down people off the dribble and 3-point shot. You know, and you can't hardly touch guys. And now in the playoffs, you know, that's why Tatum and Brown struggle, and they're used to being able to get by guys, and it's tougher for them. Yeah. Now Curry, you know, even he wasn't good last night, but he is a kind of a throwback, great without the ball.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he's a kind of a small John Havlicek. I mean, tremendous movement without the ball, yeah. As well as certainly great with the ball. I mean, he just has got the whole package. And then, of course, you know, has 35-foot of range, you know, which
he's amazing.
it kind of reminds me of an old story that Larry Bird told me once. I was always kidding about, you know, quickness and speed, you know, where Curry isn't the greatest looking athlete.
Right.
I was kidding, asking Larry, I said, you know, you don't really look that fast and quick. And he said, let me tell you something. He said, when you're the best shooter in the damn world, that makes you quicker. And I mean, it's actually a very valid point, isn't it? You know, yeah. All of a sudden you got to get up into their face out there 25 feet. Now all of a sudden you're defensively, you're in a tough spot.
Yeah, you're right. And trying to guard Steph would just be a nightmare. Absolutely.
Be a nightmare. But your point's really good. I think the playoffs, they've allowed the physicalness of the game back, whether by choice or they just can't contain it, you know. Yeah. Now, one thing I will say, though, in today's game, you know, guys, you know, basically carry the ball every time they dribble anymore. Yeah. You know, I mean, they never call that. And it's fair because everybody does it. They don't call. So it's all the same. I always thought John Morant may have taken it to new levels for Memphis. I mean, they're running backs that don't really carry the ball longer than he does. I mean, it's like, wow. I mean, not that he's a marvelous young player, but boy, that's a hell of an edge when you just put your hand on the ball and take it with you.
Yeah. Well, Coach, we've got about a minute or so left here. I'm going to ask you if you wouldn't mind coming back sometime and share some information with you.
Especially since you went to St. Benedict's. You know, I feel better about it now. I kind of feel like I won already.
Yeah, I wish you'd have been there back then.
Before we go, you and Darryl Jones.
That's it. Well, it was Darryl Jones and Vince DeGrief. That's what it was. And I was sitting there watching him win.
Darryl was what a nice man. What a nice man. You know, I mean, but I really, really had a lot of respect for him, you know, as a coach and as a person.
Yeah, he's a good guy. And I'll tell you a story about him next time we get together.
All right. Okay. All right. Maybe I'll tell you some Bill O'Connor stories. I don't know. You know, I mean, top flight guy there. That's for sure.
Yeah, I agree. Well, Jerry, thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a treat for me.